Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Jen Emily. This week, we talk about the closing of the Dallas homeless encampment, Tent City, the first court appearance of Johnny Football himself, former Texas A&M and Cleveland Browns quarterback Johnny Manziel, a portrait of a serial killer, and a new podcast. My co-host for today is Tasha DeParis, who writes about the homeless as well as criminal justice for the news. We'll also hear from reporters Sarah Mervosh and Claire Baller about a profile they did looking at a man connected to 7 victims in 2 states. Editorial writer Mike Hashimoto ends the show in our usual way on his latest hashing it out on Tent City. You might be surprised to learn that there is a Dallas woman with ties to the Boston Strangler case, or that a Fort Worth man is one of the world's leading experts on the notorious Charles Manson. Both of these people are featured in a new pop-up podcast called Strange by Dallas Morning News arts and culture editor Christopher Nguyen. You may also recognize Christopher from Mixed Media, a culture podcast he co-hosts at the news. He joins us in the studio today to briefly talk to us about the new show. Welcome.
Hi, ladies. Thanks for having me.
Anytime.
I'm always ready to talk crime stuff.
We'll have to have you back.
That's right. So this new podcast, I'm calling it a pop-up because it was sort of an experiment, and I wasn't sure if there'd be more than one or not, but the response has been really great, and we've had great traffic and good feedback, and so I now am going to be peer pressured into doing more of them. But the premise of the show basically is four people, in this case Texas writers, tell their true stories of an encounter with the strange, and two of them have actually very high-profile crime connections. The most significant one involves a Dallas woman named Virginia Savage McAllister. You may not know her name, but she is a big deal. She has written a book about architecture. She's a Dallas preservationist. Her kids and stepkids have won Oscars and written books. I mean, she is the real deal. And what I learned about her is that she had an encounter with the Boston Strangler that she has never talked about publicly. And so she tells her story on the show, and it's really chilling. And I brought a clip from it today, but I'll set it up first. In the 60s, the Boston Strangler case, just if for those who don't know, involved a series of then unsolved murders and sexual assaults in the Boston area. Usually women, someone had broken into their home, attacked them. Virginia at the time was a college student at Radcliffe College in Cambridge. She had late classes a lot of times, and on one night in particular, she had to walk home late at night. It was very cold. It was very windy. She normally took kind of the busy streets home, but in this case, she decided to take a shortcut through the park, through the Cambridge Common. It looked alone. She thought she was fine, but it turned out she was not alone. So let's hear a clip about what happened to her next.
Suddenly, almost out of nowhere, a sort of unusual man in a weird green suit just appeared and right next to me and said, you should be a model. And I just ignored him and walked faster, and he kept up with me and said, no, you need to be a model, and I'm going to help make you a model. And I took the big drawing board that was under my arm and I twisted and whapped him with it, and he fell back. And as he fell back, I felt the presence of evil.
Oh.
That's wow. Creepy.
Oh my goodness.
Creepy.
I know. I love, too, hearing these stories, like in her voice, her great sort of Texas accent, and really chilling. And you'll obviously have to listen to hear what happened next. But
so since you'd never told her story before, mm-hmm. was it difficult at all to get her to share this very eerie, scary moment? I mean, it probably isn't something that you just want to repeat knowing what could have happened.
Right. It's actually a funny story how that came about. I had reached out to Virginia because I thought in the beginning I might do a ghost story. And Virginia has, if there's anyone who might have had a ghostly encounter, it would be her, because she has traipsed through all of these old houses for years and years and years. And she wrote me back and said very politely, nope, nothing has ever happened to her. And then a few days later, I got an email from her, a follow-up, and she said, I don't know if anyone remembers the Boston Strangler, but I did have an encounter with him. And at that point, I just nearly fell out of my chair. And I was just like, yeah, that would count. Let's talk about that. And so she told me that story, and it was just, it's really chilling. It has a weird twist at the end that you'll hear. So, crazy case. The one of the other episodes I wanted to mention that has a crime angle involves a Texas writer named Jeff Quinn. He was on staff at the Fort Worth Star-Telegram for many years. And he wrote, a couple years back, the definitive biography on Charles Manson. Incredibly researched, really a richly drawn book and very disturbing. And as a sidebar, this is a great recommendation, but there's a podcast series based largely on his book called Charles Manson's Hollywood. And it's a 12-part series that came out last summer, and was a huge hit, and Vanity Fair wrote about it, and I highly recommend it. It's really interesting and fascinating, and the show that it's on is called You Must Remember This. So definitely check that out if you're interested in it. But the story that Jeff told me was about something called creepy crawling, which was an odd practice that Manson had his followers go through to sort of prepare for what would come. They didn't know that he had murder in mind, but it would basically involve his people breaking into people's homes in the middle of the night, rearranging the furniture, doing strange things in their houses, and then leaving. And then you would get up the next morning and just see that someone had been in your house and rearranging the furniture and could have killed you at any moment, but then didn't. I'm very eerie.
If I woke up and saw that, there are so many questions and possibilities in your mind. You know, it's you wonder, are they coming back? What were they doing? Did they take anything? What did they touch? What did they see? Did they look at me while I was sleeping? It's
right.
Very weird.
It is. It's very chilling. He obviously gives you more information and more detail. But anyway, there are four segments total. They're about 5 or 6 minutes each. It's about a 25-minute show. And definitely check it out because I think it's a lot of fun.
Great. And awesome. For those who want to check it out, you can listen to Strange on iTunes. Just search for the show name or for Dallas Morning News. You can stream it online at guidelive.com/podcasts. Got a strange story idea? You can reach Christopher on Twitter at Christopher Wynn. Thanks for stopping by, Christopher.
All right. Thanks, ladies.
Now let's move on to Tent City, Tasha. You've been writing about the unsheltered homeless in Dallas and really brought the city's focus to the fact that there were people in need of housing who were being ignored. Can you bring us up to speed on what actually happened this week? Because it's been a process, and now...
Tent City, it was basically a 4-block stretch of land under Interstate 45 outside of downtown near Malcolm X Boulevard. And it had been home to, at one point, estimates were around 300 people. Some people said it was more, some people said it was fewer. But that was around February that many people were living there. And around that time, two people had been killed there. One was killed, stabbed to death in a fight. And then 2 days later, city officials met and said, We have to close this down. This isn't a safe environment for people. So earlier in April, basically city leaders came together with a plan to close the encampment in sections. So they basically split it into 5 parts, and they did kind of these rolling closures where they would close one section. They gave everyone notice saying that it was coming, but they would close a section, and then people would either move into shelter or housing. A lot of caseworkers would go out there and try to work with people to find some housing for them. But if they didn't find housing, they could move kind of inward into Tent City. And that continued for several weeks until Tuesday. And Tuesday was the final day of closure. The final 2 sections were shut down. Everything was cleaned up. Fences were put in. And Tent City, as we knew it, is gone.
So where is everyone going? You said that some people were moving into shelters, but obviously there are people who want to live outside. Because of whatever their issues are, and I know mental illness is can be one of those issues, and that's something you've written about too. They don't want to be under someone's roof and have someone's rules telling them what they can and can't do.
Sure, that's definitely part of it. It is worth noting that many of the city's shelters are full. There's not a lot of space for people anyway, and people are becoming newly homeless every day. So that is definitely a factor. A lot of people did move into shelters, moved into transitional housing, and then moved into permanent supportive housing. Permanent supportive housing basically just means that if they have any kind of addiction or mental illness, that they receive social support in that housing. The issue is that there are many people who, like you said, they don't necessarily want to live outside because they want to be homeless, but they aren't comfortable in a shelter setting, especially ones who have more severe mental illness, or if they have an addiction. It's hard for them because they can't take obviously drugs or alcohol into a shelter system. Also, many of the people in Tent City, a majority actually had criminal records. Many of them had felonies, and that made it difficult for them to find housing. They couldn't really get a job, and a lot of them are uncomfortable in an institutionalized living situation. Many said that they felt like going to a shelter was like back being back in prison. So at this point, there are other encampments nearby Tent City that have grown since its closure. So it's going to be something that the city is going to have to continue to tackle for a while.
And is this something that the city is going to keep looking at? It's not, you know, Tent City problem solved, you know, or do they kind of feel like this is, they've made done what they can for now? Or where do things stand?
Well, I certainly don't think they think that it's problem solved, because the problem is not solved. There are still many unsheltered homeless people in the city. The official count is that there are more than 600 people who are homeless and have no shelter at all in the city. But others who work closely with homeless populations say that there's significantly more than that. So it's not a problem that's just going to go away by closing one encampment. I know that there has been discussion about possibly bringing a bond election before voters that would include permanent supportive housing. But that is, you know, a long-term solution. There are a lot of other issues in dealing with mental illness and addiction and people's reintegration into society after they've been released from prison. And then just the issue of poverty in the city. So I do think that Tent City definitely kind of brought the focus onto the problem. But closing Tent City itself wasn't the end of that. It's really just the beginning of the work that's going to be done.
So Tasha and I were there today for Johnny Football, Johnny Manziel's court hearing today for a domestic violence case. It was a bond hearing and a bit of a circus.
Definitely a circus.
Yeah, not even a bit, just definitely a circus.
Absolutely a circus.
The hearing was maybe 3 minutes plus time for the attorneys to talk to each other and then the judge afterward. The judge basically laid down the ground rules of Manziel's bond. Let's hear from the judge now.
Mr. Manziel, you know my job as judge is just to make sure that you get a fair shot at the process. Okay, that's one of the jobs that I have now as judge. My other job as judge is just to make sure that everybody in the case stays safe. So that includes yourself. Miss Crowley as well, okay? So I'm going to issue two conditions of bond. The first is I'm going to order that you have no contact with Miss Crowley, okay? So by no contact, what I mean by that is that you can't call her, you can't text her, you can't email her, you can't send her any letters or go to where she's at, okay?
Sure.
I'm going to add to that, and I'm not suggesting that you are doing these things or that you would even consider doing these things, but I'm just going to add that you can't try to follow her or do anything like that, all right?
Sure.
The responsibility of following this part of my order is on you, okay?
And in addition to that, the judge asked Manziel, do you have any guns? And he said no. And the judge asked, do you live where there are guns? And he said no. And Johnny Manziel had to sign a affidavit saying that he had no guns, wasn't living around guns, and this is something that's recently started in Dallas County after some stories that the Dallas Morning News did, actually that Sarah Mervosh and I did, about the county not enforcing gun laws to take guns away from people who had been convicted of domestic violence cases and people who are out on bond for domestic violence cases.
So, Jen, I mean, these seem like pretty normal restrictions. I mean, don't contact the person that you're accused of assaulting and, you know, don't have a weapon. Was there anything unexpected today?
There was nothing unexpected. I mean, it was your basic hearing in court that pretty much anybody who's out on bond gets, that they tell you what you can, what you can't do. And they could have forbidden Manziel from leaving the state or Dallas County. They could have made some other requirements, but they didn't do that. And it's possible that if something happens, they may add restrictions. That's always a possibility. But there was really nothing unexpected. His attorney said that Manziel's going to go back to Los Angeles and live his life. There's another court date set for June, but Manziel doesn't have to be there, and it's actually not even really a court date. It's the attorneys talk to each other and just check in on the case and, you know, see where things are. This is how plea bargains happen. This is how the state, the prosecutors turn over the evidence that they have to the defense. It's just a discussion process, and it takes a while.
So it's likely going to be months before we know what actually happens with this case, because he didn't submit any kind of plea today, right?
Right. No plea. His attorneys say he's going to plead not guilty, but there was no testimony. It was not at all about what did or didn't happen on that night with Colleen Crowley. It was basically a bond hearing, and right, this is what you can't do, and a chance for him to go before the judge and the judge to meet Johnny Manziel, the chance for Johnny Manziel to have to come to court and sit there and, you know, and see what was going on and know who he has to report to if things go sideways, if things go wrong.
So basically a rather minor thing that is made much bigger because of who Johnny Manziel is.
Exactly. If Johnny Manziel wasn't Johnny Football, if he wasn't, you know, a Heisman Trophy winner who played for the Aggies and then the Cleveland Browns and then continued to kind of make a spectacle of himself after he got dropped by the Browns by partying and getting his photo taken with Justin Bieber at a Bieber concert, and we wouldn't have as much interest. I mean, this happens every day that court is in session, which is pretty much every day except for holidays and weekends. Earlier this week, Sarah Mervosh and Claire Baller sat down and talked about their profile of a serial killer. He recently led authorities to two bodies in the field, including that of a Denton College student missing for 19 years.
We're here to talk with Claire Baller and Sue Dietrich, a private investigator and former Tiki Island police chief, to talk about the case of William Reese, a serial killer who has been tied to attacks on 7 women, and 4 of them have ended up killed. And we just recently learned that he was a serial killer. Claire, how did we get into this story?
So almost 20 years ago, a UNT student by the name of Kelly Cox went missing in Denton after attending a class. And for almost 20 years, it was unknown where she was. Her family had no clues, no indication as to what happened to this young mother. And in this past February, a suspect, William Reese, came forward and led authorities to where he confessed to having buried her body in Houston. It turned out that his claims were true. Her remains were found and were just identified this past April. And so that case is really what sparked us on to follow and really dig into the history of William Reese and who this man was, because we know that he's been a suspect in not just one, not just two, but now at least 7 cases
Involving attacks on women. Not all of them ended in death, but they are attacks,
right,
on women.
Kidnapping, murder, and sometimes rape.
Definitely. And so, Sue, you have investigated William Reese for almost 2 decades. How did you first get involved in looking into him?
I was the chief of police in Tiki Island when Jessica Kane was abducted. And prior to that, I had done a hypnosis on a young lady that was kidnapped by the name of Sandra Sapaw. She was abducted from Webster, Texas, and she managed to escape. And so I'm a forensic hypnotist, and so I was asked to hypnotize her to see if we could get some more information about who was responsible for kidnapping her. And so under the hypnosis, she described many things, which led to identifying William Reese. And he was put in a live lineup, and she picked him out. And
that case proved to be crucial, because there was this period in 1997 where there were at least five women who went missing, and she was the only one who had escaped, because she actually threw herself from his moving truck on the highway. She was pregnant at the time, and she threw herself out of his truck in order to escape, and which led to IDing him several months later, which proved to be crucial and putting him behind bars, because he was eventually convicted.
That's correct.
So, Sue, I mean, if she hadn't have gotten away, like, I mean, how crucial was that she was able to get away and ID him?
Well, it was very crucial, because otherwise he probably would not have been convicted and would still be committing murders.
And you've described him as someone who, you know, was a, quote, monster, a predator. How did he get away with this? Why was he so good at it?
I don't know how he did it, but he did it. And he he just preyed on, for the most part, the same type of a victim. And he just, back in 97, DNA, they had not perfected it. And it wasn't until Oklahoma submitted his DNA just recently that they were able to clear their cold case on Tiffany Johnston.
Yeah, and Claire, so there, we've mentioned several victims so far. Would you want to give us sort of an overview of the victims that have been connected to Reese and sort of how we got to this point?
So the first case that we know of William Reese dates back to 1986, where a young University of Oklahoma freshman was abducted after her car broke down. And after 4 to 5 hours of being locked inside the sleeper cab of Reese's semi, she was able to escape. Shortly after that, a woman was stalked from coming home from a bar, and she woke up to Reese straddling her in her bed.
So he was convicted in both of those cases for kidnapping and rape.
Yes, and he served 10 years for those. Shortly after being let out of prison, after serving that sentence, he then made his way from Oklahoma and moved down to Houston. And it was April of 1997 that the first girl disappeared, and that was Laura Smither, who was 12 years old. She disappeared after going on a run in her Friendswood neighborhood, and her body was found in a pond several days later. Now, Reese has not, he's been a suspect and still remains a suspect in that case, but he's not been tied to that through DNA or anything. But
he hasn't been charged, but his attorney does not deny his involvement in that case.
Correct, yeah. Then after that is the case of Sandra Sapot, which is, she's the young girl who Sue used hypnosis on. She's the young woman who threw herself out of the vehicle and survived. And then after that brings us to Kelly Cox in July of 1997. She's a UNT student who went missing and whose remains were just found in Houston.
And so if you can sort of visualize this, he's in Oklahoma. There's these two attacks. He gets sent to prison for 10 years. He gets out in 1996, and several months later in Houston, there's someone goes missing. There's two attacks in Houston. Then he's moving up the interstate to Denton, outside
of
Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens?
So then that's July 15th of 1997 that Kelly Cox goes missing. Then July 26th, 1997, Tiffany Johnston goes missing. Now, that's the young girl who Sue just mentioned that Reese was just linked to via DNA just this past September. And she was found murdered days after she went missing in Oklahoma. Then we have the case of Jessica Kane. She went missing August of 97. In the Houston-Galveston area.
So he goes back to Houston. So, Sue, you've got all these cases, and for so long, I mean, he was a convicted rapist and kidnapper, and he has been serving 60 years for kidnapping Sandra Sapot, who you helped put that together. But we did not know that there were these murder cases associated with him. So why do you think he's speaking out now and helping authorities find these two bodies in the Houston area?
Well, it's certainly not because he wants to bring closure to the family. He does not want the death penalty. And so that is, it's my opinion that there was a deal made that if he would tell where all the bodies are, that he could avoid the death penalty and spend the rest of his natural life in prison. So it's certainly not because he feels some remorse. It's because he doesn't want the needle in his arm.
Yeah, so his attorney told me that he wanted to help bring closure to the families, and obviously you disagree with that. And actually, we talked to an expert on serial killers who also didn't quite believe that he would do it just sort of out of the goodness of his heart if he, in fact, is a sexual sadist, as it seems that he is. But his attorney said that he wanted to do it to bring closure to the families, and as well as to avoid the death penalty. That was part of the deal. So in this past fall, when he was charged with murder in Oklahoma, that was the first time he had been charged with murder. And so then the Texas Rangers went to him and said, hey, maybe we can close these other cases. Let's see what we can do to avoid execution. And it's my understanding, I don't know that a formal deal, at least publicly, has been made, but there seems to be some sort of deal that at least in Texas, he would not be charged. He would not be given the death penalty, but the Texas authorities cannot speak for Oklahoma. And so at that point, that's where the sort of the rub is. It's like, what's going to happen in that Oklahoma case? And interestingly, the mother of the Oklahoma victim actually knew Reese and his mother back when all of this went down, when her daughter was found killed. She was friends with Reese's mother. Reese's mother did the family's ironing. And so she actually once took him to get a driver's license, and they knew each other. And so she never thought that Reese was a victim or was the suspect in her daughter's disappearance. And his mother actually pressed her daughter's burial outfit. So it's pretty somber.
Sue, do you think that there are other victims that we don't know about yet?
Absolutely. And let me just say one thing to go back to what you were talking about earlier. He didn't want to bring closure to this family, any of these families, until he got caught. So it's not like he came forward and said, I need to talk to someone while I'm in prison. I need to bring closure for these families. He got caught, and he knew that he could possibly get the death penalty. That's why he's telling the authorities about where he dropped, you know, where he these girls. July 21st, 1997, he kidnapped a young girl named Anjanette Sorrentino, the same method that he used for Sandra Sapoff. Cut her tire. She was at a convenience store late at night, cut her tire, abducted her, drug her into the woods, and he had an accomplice at that time. He ended up killing that accomplice, murdering that accomplice.
And that's based on your investigation, but there hasn't been any formal charges
not yet.
In that case.
Not yet. Right. So he's coming forward because he doesn't want the death penalty. And there are more bodies.
So do you think they'll get more out of him?
Well, I hope so. But like all crooks that I've dealt with, they're not going to tell you anything that you don't already know about or suspect him in. So
So, Sue, one of the interesting things in this case is that a lot of the victims were alone. They were having car trouble, and they were you know, typically conscientious young women, but they just, you know, might have needed help in that moment, and they sort of succumbed to this Good Samaritan. What advice do you have from the law enforcement perspective for women who are in that position?
Well, I just think that because he's a predator, and most of these girls were taken, except for the girl in Denton, most of them were taken late at night. And I think now with cell phones so prevalent that you can call 911, don't get out of your car. And these girls were just trusting, and that's what happened. And so there are other options for them, calling 911, not getting out of your car, being aware of your surroundings, because Sandra Sapaw didn't even notice him. It wasn't until she pulled into a restaurant, you know, that he pulled up to her and said, got a flat tire. And that was the beginning.
Well, thank you so much, Sue. We really appreciate you having you on. And thank you, Claire. You can read our story online at dallasnews.com, and it should be in Sunday's paper.
Okay, thank you so much. I appreciate all your hard work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sue.
That's all for today. Thanks for listening. You'll hear the latest Hashing It Out in just a moment. Stay tuned to dallasnews.com for more coverage of criminal justice issues. Remember to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We are at Texas Crimecast. Thanks to our sound engineer, Tommy Noel, for Tasha DeParis, Christopher Wynn, Sarah Mervosh, and Claire Baller, I'm Jen Emily. We hope you stay safe out there. Now we drop the mic.
Dallas isn't the first U.S. city to struggle with homelessness. It won't be the last. By and large, the people who chase a solution have good hearts in the right place. The fundamental problem is there's not a single answer because there's not a single reason people live outdoors. Circumstances overtake some, and they will accept help. Others choose the life, and no amount of do-goodering will change that. Mental health problems or drug and alcohol addiction make the streets the last stop for others. In Dallas, city officials have finally cleared a large settlement called Tent City from under a freeway overpass near downtown. The city moved in after months of indecision and complaints, only after stabbings and other crime made the problem impossible to ignore. Some of the evicted campers wandered to new sites. Some accepted the city's help and moved to shelters or other housing. Others simply vanished for now, but will turn up again. A new idea is to repurpose a retired Navy base on the western edge of town as the new encampment. It hinges on $50 million in private donations. Miami famously tried an outdoor homeless pavilion. San Francisco mostly gave up and built outdoor urinals and parks. The Navy base idea is another good-hearted plan doomed to fail, if only because even the homeless have an instinct to choose. How many will choose to live isolated and miles from the services they know? If there were an easy fix, we'd have found it by now, and that might be our final answer.